carry out a certain amount of tasks, you have granted me authority to do that. You've given me your vote of confidence. I'm a trusted servant. If I don't perform well, you can jerk me out just that quick. Yes.
Dave, alcoholic.
Isn't
it the responsibility of, through my 2 years of service work as a general service representative, not in any of these districts, in California. But
poor baby.
Something that I don't see, and this concerns me, is that in any of the meetings that I attend, you know, it was my responsibility as general service representative of my home group to come back and discuss these issues that I would then discuss with the delegate who would then take it to a vote. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that. And I'm just wondering, is when you just said authority, it just rang the bells in my head that, you know, in your experience, have you seen a problem with GSRs going without consulting the group on issues?
Of course. My major problem has always been the group that won't listen to the GSR. You're going to the wrong meetings. Come to my group. We have our once a month is our GSR and our central office rep and our district committee person's meeting. If they can get it done in 10 minutes, fine. If not, they got the whole meeting. So we want to know what's going on.
I was a delegate not too long ago in this area, and I made it a point to get around to every district, and I made it to every district in this state at least once, some more than once. And I used that existing service structure in the building of this group conscience. And part of what I did was not just stand up there and talk for 30 minutes or whatever it was, but buttonhole the GSRs, take them aside and say, what's going on? To keep your ear to the wheel. I was a delegate, but I'm also a human being. I didn't drink any better than any of you. So what it ended up to be was I got way out there. Jesus, I started believing what I was saying half the time. And as a result, you know, it's real easy to get yourself away from what the heartbeat is. And so I used the service structure, and the DCMs were of absolutely invaluable in the building of this conscience. Made a lot of good friends as a result, you know. So, the structure, all the components are here. Everything's in place. Everything works. And, you know, the greasy wheel gets the grease, you know. And so everything's there. But our problem is we just seem to think that it's just not good enough. It just don't work. There's something wrong with this picture. But we don't use what's here. See? And, you know, the only way to change that is to try to have sessions like this and things like that. Hopefully we get some people informed and make some change at a substantive level.
At home, everybody participates. Each child has a vote. I have two. My wife has two, because we are responsible for carrying out all the tests that will come out of that. But they get to participate. Sounds completely unfair, but it works. Okay. Decisions are based on participation, but the decisions are made. The buck does stop somewhere. And that's with the person who's responsible for carrying out the task. They have to have the right of decision. And if we did it wrong, you got a right of appeal. The minority opinion can be heard.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic. I just wanted to say something about this one vote thing, because I attend a lot of meetings that I really love. And if there's a group conscience in that meeting, I want to bring a message of, I think it's my sort of responsibility to bring a message of substantial anonymity, or, you know, that there's a huge majority before something changes, or before, you know, something is voted in. And I always look at voting as the last thing we really need to do. Mm-hmm. Right. The real process is the discussion.
Right.
And I love this concept about no second class AA, because the guy that's like 24 hours sober that wants to attend a group conscience, I want him to talk and I want him to have a vote, even if he's not informed. Now, this took me some time to actually accept, because I've had some occasions where, I've had people at district meetings or at group consciences that objected to something that the informed group really knew about and thought about and talked to a lot of other people about, and this person just showed up. But sometimes out of that, I can learn something, and I can get out of my own arrogance. So I guess what I want to say is that because I go to other groups, I'm not just going to one home group. I do attend other group consciences, and I do intend to vote because I want to be heard, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other thing is to remember that everyone that does show up at a group conscience should have that same right as well.
I've had the unhealthy experience of being in a group of perhaps 10 members, and one person decided they wanted to do something else, and they went out and brought in 15 of their friends and turned everything around, and that's not right. With respect to its own affairs, each group should be autonomous. Chuck.
I'm Chuck, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober since the 7th day of April, 1982. And I'm a GSR for the Saturday Night Jive in Boulder. And I'm also involved in the jail program. Ever since I've been in this program, I've always had a home group. Wherever I've lived, I have been a member of a group. It was my home group. And I attended all their steering committee meetings and all of their group conscience meetings. And I think that's my responsibility, to help guide that group. Is my understanding, and I could be totally wrong, but I understand that the GSO recommendation is that everybody should have one home group and not be a member of every group that you attend their meetings. I'm a member of the Saturday Night Jive group, but I go to several other meetings, quite a few. But I don't vote in their group consciences. If they have an issue that they're going to send the GSR to area to carry their message to area assembly, having, I think Don implied that with his last statement, bringing in a bunch of people to control the vote of a group and then going to another group and controlling that group's vote twists the picture. You don't get a true picture of what the AA community is really wanting. So in our group, we have a kind of a policy. If it involves an issue that's going out of the meeting, out of the group, going to area assembly or to district, only members of that group can vote on it. If it's an issue that involves how we're going to arrange the chairs at the meeting or what kind of coffee we're going to serve, and a person is a regular attendee of that meeting, they're welcome to vote on that. But not on issues that are going to be carried past the group level.
Any other discussion on participation? And I think that is in the home group heartbeat of AA. I think that's in that book or paper. Concept 5. Throughout our world service structure, a traditional right of appeal ought to prevail, thus assuring us that minority opinion will be heard, and that petitions for the redress of personal grievances will be carefully considered. We talked a little bit last night about minority opinion. There's been a kind of a thing going on lately that some people started looking at this minority opinion as maybe it's being misused and perhaps abused in some cases. I don't know if I necessarily totally agree with that, although I will say this, that in the general service conference, in spite of efforts of groups of delegates to pass resolutions that say if you bring it up this year, you can't bring it up next year if it gets defeated. It generally is the case that if something gets blowed up, you bring it back next year. And so as a result, somebody was talking about, Gary, and you were talking about before the meeting about a concept's window shade. Now they got, okay. When I was delegate the first year, it was on the slate. That was in 93. And I'm sure it came up at least once or twice before then. So this thing just been coming up. And understand you had a real pissing contest at the group, and you know, half of them saying hell no, and the other half said hell yes, and this is just, hey, you know, that's how it is. Not done till it's done. And I don't know what done means. See, sometimes, I'll tell you one that we got involved in. And this is a very rare thing that happens in a conference. We had commissioned to write and had produced a draft of the second 25-year history of Alcoholics Anonymous to succeed AA Comes of Age. And it was intended to kind of bring it up to, about 1975 or 80 or so. The trustees' literature committee was unanimously behind the conference committee adopting this draft and putting this thing forward into publication. The conference literature committee took a draft, or they had 11 drafts copied. They read it and unanimously rejected the book. And here they were. And they would not find the middle. They would not find the middle. And you never heard the name calling and finger pointing? And frothy emotional appeal didn't work? Now, who was in the minority there, see? This was during the discussion. So the thing had never come to a vote. And it became obvious after a period of time that we had a huge polarized situation here. And so rather than call for a vote and have a hung jury, where it would be a little difficult to say who was in the minority, or that even a minority report could be filed, or appeal could have been filed, the chairman of the board asked that the two heads of the two committees and one appointee from each committee go out in the hallway and stare her down like human beings. And they did. And they went out. They were out there about 2.5 hours. I don't know what happened. I wasn't a member of that committee. There was some, every once in a while you'd hear something go thump, thump. they came back with a compromise, and the compromise very simply was that the conference committee would recommend that this thing be put on the shelf for 2 years, and that at such time that everybody had been cleared out of the battle, they'd look at it again. And then I think it was in Dave's rotation, or maybe one after that, that they looked at, it was Linda's, I guess it was. They looked at it and they just, there it sits. Nothing been happening. That was a $600,000 book. And you know what most of that money was spent on? Lawsuits.
It had some real juicy stuff in it.
What the hell was the book? This right of appeal is important. We don't, you know, there is a process you can go through at any, theoretically, at any level, where if you feel that the conference action, the group action, the district action, area action, whatever, is wrong, that you can file a minority report. Now, it's so seldom used, I don't know that there's a whole lot of people around that even know how to do that in a technical sense. But I know probably at the conference level, at least, you can file it through the conference coordinator. Now, where it goes from there, I think, is a subject of a lot of speculation and discussion. I don't know how far we want to go into that. But even at the group level and at the area level, same principle is involved. And I wonder why it is, how come that once we do get our way in the vote and we carry the day, then all of a sudden it comes up again and say, wait a minute, we settled that. That isn't always the case.
Thank you.
This concept covers the tyranny of the majority is something we must guard against. 51% is not good enough, particularly in terms of spiritual matters and life and death matters. So for our conference purposes, it's been pretty well established that it takes two-thirds vote to be binding on the trustees. If two-thirds of the conference, that becomes a conference action, the trustees must act on it. With one exception, there's a provision in the charter that if the trustees can see that this is we've had some last-minute, quick emotional stuff, it would cost $5 million. The trustees can say, no, not without further investigation here. That's their right of appeal. They can put a plug on it. Otherwise, two-thirds or more is binding on the trustees. And 50% more is a very strong suggestion you do something about it. That seems to have worked so well. The trustees very seldom have ever had to pull the plug, but there have been some occasions, and may still be some occasions. The counterbalance to that is that the conference can, if it wishes, remove any or all of the trustees in one meeting. Out they go. So there's that lovely balance there that nobody pushes the power around. But I've been at one conference, we had a very emotional appeal at the last minute over a piece of literature that should never have been printed. But everybody was tired. You were there. Everybody was tired. It was time to go home. And the appeal was really good. Had us all in tears. So we printed it. I don't think we sold 10 of them. The people it was written for said, we don't need that. And because nobody exercised this, it went on through. The Native American pamphlet. It just was not, it was not well thought out. Personal punitive measures are never taken in AA theoretically. If they are, you can, again, write an appeal specifically. It goes to the chairman of the board. It goes to the delegates. You've got a way of saying, wait a minute, this was not right. I don't know of any case where that's actually happened. It's just, it's available to you as a delegate. We're going to keep the balance. Nobody has too much power. Now, conference is made up. Two-thirds of the vote is delegates. The conference structure is always based on the delegates having two-thirds of the vote. If they could all ever get together, they could run the show. They were never worried about that as trustees because they can never all get together. Okay. The directors on some of the standing committees, or some of the boards, not the committees, but on the boards, are also given a vote at conference because they're involved in the day-to-day working of our board. See, we have three boards. I guess you all know that. General Service Board, which has oversight over the whole operation. And that in owns two more boards, which are both, in essence, publishing houses, AA World Services Incorporated and the Grapevine Incorporated. And they appoint directors and trustees to those boards. They vote for themselves. That's the way trustees are put together. They just vote for themselves. But the conference has a vote as to who gets voted on, in most cases. There was a period of time where that was not so. We had some what were known as general service trustees. They were just people that had been serving on one of the boards, and they just automatically got onto the general service board. And we ran into an interesting problem with that when I was on the board. We have 21 trustees, 14 alcoholic and 7 non-alcoholic, to keep the balance. It turned out that at one point, 11 of our trustees had absolutely no service experience whatsoever, and 10 did. So things were not well balanced. If you've been through the general service structure, you think a different way than anybody on the planet. And if you haven't, you don't think that way. And so we had some problems with that, which has since been rectified. So this is an ongoing, continuing process, and all this can be changed along the way and has been. If you read it, there are footnotes as to where the changes were and why they were made. This right of appeal I like. I've never had to use it, but I sure like the idea that I can write a letter and it'll get listened to. May not be agreed with, but it will be listened to. Because the process takes it to the chairman of the board and to everybody else who might be involved. That's all I know about it.
Why don't we'll take this question, then why don't we take a break?
Just a quick one. Is this right of appeal have to center around a vote that was made, or can it just be something going on in Alcoholics Anonymous?
I think it can be as to any aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay.
At the conference level.
Okay. If that took it back to something, I know one thing that's on my mind that we've been talking about here is a conference action was taken in 95. Is there any, there ain't no time limit or anything on that? Could you write an appeal on something that was done in 95 and it would still be addressed, just, you know, because it's a different board and everything?
Yeah. You know, this is where I want to get back just for a second to this service structure. If I take it as an individual member and I decide that I don't like the fact that they took the great pages out of the grapevine, I write a letter to the Grapevine Board, and I say, "Dear Board, put them great pages back in, love, Gary." I'm really trying to be about halfway serious as an example, but they'll say, "Thanks for sharing, next." What can they do with information like that? I mean, that's just kind of a do this or else, or else what? Now, if I was to go to the group and say, "What do you all think about the great pages in the grapevine?" They say, "We don't care, we want our 12-step drunks." Say, "Okay, well, how about two or three of you, we get together for coffee afterwards, talk about putting the great pages back in the grapevine." Okay, so we get it sold at something resembling the group level. They take it to the district decides, "Hey, this is not a bad plan, why don't we go ahead and do it?" Takes it to the area assembly says, "Hey, this is a hell of a deal, let's make a conference action." Okay, we've got half the battle done, right? No, you've got to survive. Got to survive it through a trustee committee. We got to get it through a conference committee. Got to get it on the floor of a conference to vote. And you know what? A lot of the people, the only reason they buy the grapevine is because the great pages ain't in there anymore. So where are we going? See, and this is, I don't say this to dissuade you from if you really and truly believe that this is something wrong. But what it's just an example of, this is what you got to get through to get something to happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's purposely almost impossible to change anything.
It really slows it down, and that's good for us.
Because when we act in haste, we do stupid things, you see. But when we act after much discussion, after a thorough, and boy, that word cannot be used enough, thorough airing of the facts, then we usually can come to some consensus.
We still do stupid things, but at least it's well thought out. Yeah. Well thought out.
I just want to add, there's a little group up in Winnipeg, Canada, who back in the early 90s addressed a situation. We were publishing foreign big books without the doctor's opinion and some other information in it. And they called GSO on it, and John Johnson up there sent me all the information, all the correspondence back and forth, and as far as I know, this was never done, but GSO changed their minds on it. Mm-hmm. So,
and they have a right of decision and all the other things,
okay.
they can do that. That's
okay.
Right. Before we break, Chuck wants to make an announcement. Oh, my God.
Up on the food table, the grazing table, two of these prints up there, I'm going to have a pencil laying up there.
Survey as a whole, our General Service Conference has the principal responsibility for the maintenance of our world services, and it traditionally has the final decision respecting large matters of general policy and finance. But the conference also recognizes that the chief initiative and active responsibility in most of these matters should be exercised primarily by the trustee members of the conference when they act among themselves as the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's umbrella of the General Service Board is a, I think it's already been mentioned, but is like a parent company to two New York corporations, one Grapevine and the other is AWS Inc., which has the intellectual properties that are owned by Alcoholics Anonymous, which would be the copyrights primarily.
and the rights to publishing. This particular concept is a delegated authority concept. It deals with the same thing that we as an area assembly give our area committee the opportunity to do, to be responsible for and to take care of most of the business that the area assembly deems is within its purvey to take care of. And, you know, it's a proven fact that if the conference itself had to actually try to handle this stuff on a day-to-day basis, it would be very much like trying to get a worldwide vote of groups to do, you know, whether or not we was going to publish that concept's window shade deal or whatever the topic at hand might be. And a lot of this, although it seems like it's kind of covered up with stuff, what it is, it's trying to codify this business of mutual trust. And it's trying to set up a structure whereby this mutual trust thing isn't just some whimsical, little poem that we say, or we don't just give it lip service. It actually has some depth and weight and some meaning. And so one of the things that the conference has to recognize is that they are not generally given the responsibility for the day-to-day management of the affairs of the General Service Office. Every conference that I'm aware of has a faction of delegates that absolutely can't get their hands out of that and have to micromanage and tell them how to do it and what color it is and, you know, and where, how come you spent, can't you guys go second-class postage? And, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So, thank you. So anyway, just another example of the fact that the General Service Board has been given basically the authority by the conference and ultimately at the top of the ladder by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole to take care of the business end of Alcoholics Anonymous.
The trustees have to make a lot of decisions. Oh, and let's take a couple. For instance, Alcoholics Anonymous is requested to be present at a number of different kinds of medical conventions and other conventions throughout the year. Through our CPC committee, they want us to set up a booth at national conferences, for instance. Well, the board's job is to determine the policy. Do we do that, first of all? Yes, we do. Now, how do we do that? And which of these come in? We'll get maybe 100, 150 requests a year. We only honor 52 of them. So the board will make those decisions based on the policy that, yes, we will cooperate with our friends, and here are the circumstances by which we will do that. And without asking anybody's permission, we even made up some traveling displays, CPC displays, that would go out both with the team from General Service in the big conventions, or if you had a local one that you had been requested to in this area, there was a traveling display that would be shipped to you. So you had a really good presentation to give at the booth, not just some stack of literature somewhere. Those are based on policy that the board established. They make those decisions and don't even ask anybody's permission to do so. And that's as it should be. This covers that. our public relations policy is established by the board. We are subjected to the public press now and then, not as much as we used to be, because we're old news, frankly. But it still comes on. So let's say Dan Rather wants to do an interview with somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous. One of our non-alcoholic trustees will go take care of that. When an award is coming our way, one of our non-alcoholic trustees will accept it because they don't have any anonymity. It's not necessary. This is policy. So we know exactly what to do, and somebody's picked, and it all gets taken care of. In 1987, the State Department put together the first trip to the Soviet Union. And it was requested that we send someone. And it happened so fast that the normal policy would be that the trustees at large, that's one of their tasks, because they don't have a constituency, if you will. And we were both on the international committee. That's one of our job assignments. It happened too fast. So the board, by a telephone poll, picked John Bragg, our general service office manager, to go because he was available, it was easy, it was quick, and he was knowledgeable. We didn't ask your permission for that either. We just did it because it's based on policy that we will cooperate. He came back with the understanding that it was a show-and-tell trip and that they were getting ready to come to this country. And again, we're cooperating with the State Department through Hazleton because Dan Anderson was requested to put the trip together. And the trip was going to be these Russians would be broken into three different teams over a 10-day period. They wanted to see what this country did about alcoholism. So there would be tours of treatment centers and EAP programs, and Dan said right off the bat, if you don't have AA members on this trip, you're wasting everybody's time. So, this is a friend of ours, in case you didn't know that. So the board picked the three people that would go on that trip. The two trustees at large and the secretary of the International Committee. That's the policy. So the decision was made. There was no favoritism. Those are the folks that would handle this. So Webb Johnson took the California group, and I took the group that went up through the middle of the country, and Sarah Price was with the group going up the East Coast. Fun trip. I wish I had time to tell you about the whole thing. Sarah called me from Delaware and says, why did we do this? You know? And I was feeling the same way. All I did was carry luggage. And every time anybody asked a question about AA, somebody else answered. And so by the time we got to Chicago, my ego was bruised. So our tour guide, they got some buses from one of the local Skid Row joints, and the driver was a black jazz musician, and he and I speak the same language, so I figured, hell with the Russians. He and I started having some fun. And the next thing I know, the Russians want to talk to me, because they're having fun, too. They've been bored stiff by all this show and tell. And things began to occur. Anyway, the trustees made that decision, as they should. This is policy and administration. This was followed by a request from the Russians that we send a delegation from Alcoholics Anonymous to the Soviet Union at their request. That took a great deal of discussion at the trustee board level as to, first of all, should we even do that? Are we cooperating or are we promoting? We went through some agonies because it was our decision to make. We knew we did not need to, nor would we be foolish enough to ask you. We had to decide, should we, and then how should we, and then who should we send? And of course, as you know, that trip took place. We went as tourists, because that's how they said to go. They said, if you go with the official, it's another show and tell. They'll take you where they want to see you. What you need to do, our Russian friend said, is that you've got our names and here's a bunch of other names. Write to all these people and say, we're going to be coming through Moscow on such and such a date. We'd like to stop by and see you. And that's what we did. And so we scheduled our trip that way. Spent 17 days on that trip just talking to people about AA. And some remarkable things happened. But the trustees made those decisions based on these principles and their obligation to make that kind of decision as to whether we should or shouldn't and how we should go about it. They flew us coach. I thought that was kind of cheap. That's a 22-hour flight from Moscow. Damn. In coach. The Nobel Peace Prize discussion. The trustees we've given them the authority to make decisions on those kinds of issues, trusting that they will take time to fully consider it, which we did. When I talk about going crazy at the board level, it's the same as any group. We really discuss all the lunatic ideas that are available until we come to consensus. I still got to go about this thing. And nothing happens even on the board without a two-thirds majority. The recommendation won't pass without two-thirds. God, there's so many stories I'd like to share with you about that. I learned to trust the process, even though I do not to this day trust all the people involved in the process. The process does work. It has its own safeguards, and it's mostly about communication. As long as we keep talking, we will eventually come out with the right solution, particularly if the minority will speak up when we have made the wrong decision. Keep us talking, and we'll be okay. I'm trying to think of some of the other policy measures the board has. Well, your literature. You don't get to vote on your literature. That's one of the favorite places for me because it takes so long to get a piece of literature through. You're looking at a 2 to 3 to 4 year process from the time somebody brings it up till it actually happens. Yes, please.
Just a question on, does this pertain, what you're talking about, to the same process that happened to the removal of the circle and triangle?
In a fashion.
Yeah. I'm going to give you my view of it.
Holy Christ.
I think it was one of the most brilliant moves that our General Service Office Manager ever made. Okay? We were about to get into litigation, bad litigation, over a symbol that's used by over 55 other outfits anyway. It's not ours. Bill warned us, don't copyright these things. Because if you copyright or trademark something, you're required by law to defend it if somebody else uses it, or you lose it. So, and this is just my view of it, what I watched George do, and I know him pretty well, so I think I'm close, is he saw to it that we stopped using it, so we don't have to ever defend it. And because we won't defend it, it will eventually go into the public domain, and then we can use it again. And at the same time, if you were reading and listening, the word from GSO was, we're the only one that can't use it. If you want to use it as a group or an area, use it.
Right.
It's just GSO will not defend it in court. We would rather lose the copyright. A very positive thing that took place. Is that how you saw it happen?
Yes. Yeah, it was a sticky wicket. We had actually initiated litigation against one chip manufacturer for failing to take the circle and triangle off. The problem, the wicket that the Board of Trustees was in, was that it is against the law in New York and nearly every other state to dilute assets. And trademarks and copyrights are considered assets, intellectual properties. And so for us to... It wasn't that we had a choice. We had no choice but to defend ourselves against misuse of our trademark. So, or else the board was subject to a proceeding by the New York Attorney General's office was ready to file a suit against the Board of Trustees for diluting assets. It was a lose-lose all the way around. And it was the only way out, what he's talking about. And it was a huge strategic move. The conference was not happy, you know, and it was, you know, there was a lot of personalities involved in this discussion, and there was appearances made that we had just suddenly decided to do this litigation, but that came as a result of an opinion letter from counsel that basically said, we're in trouble with this thing. Very much like the copyright thing, I'm sure, shut down. We didn't know it was happening until it was too late.
Does that answer that?
Yeah.
We could still use it.
Yeah. It's just the General Service Board will not use it as an official symbol anymore.
Yeah.
There's some question actually as to whether or not we probably stole it in the first place, but...
Well, we did a survey in 86 to see how often it was being used. We found 55 other entities, including civil defense, that used the same symbol. The Swiss Auto Club uses the same symbol. It's a very ancient symbol. So we shouldn't have copyrighted in the first place, and Bill even mentions that in here. Don't trademark and copyright these things. But we do.
Yeah. We need that.
Any other questions?
When was it copyrighted?
Trademarked.
Trademarked.
It was trademarked in 59?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. When we became big business.
When we came of age.
Yeah. He gave the keys of the car to the 6-year-old.
Yeah. That's it. Drive, baby, drive. Okay. No further on that.
Thank you for the question. That's the kind of stuff that will make this work. We don't know what you need to know.
Right. Let's go to,
too much.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Let's go to Concept 7 conference. This is about out there. The one aspect of this I'd like to talk about just for a second is the money side of it. Like our seventh tradition and indeed our seventh step. The conference recognizes that the charter and bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments, which they are. They're New York corporations. One's for profit, the other is a not-for-profit. That the trustees are thereby fully empowered to manage and conduct all the World Service Affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is further understood that the conference charter, which is in the front of the concept, is itself not a legal document, that it relies instead upon the force of tradition and the power of the AA purse for its final effectiveness. Very simply, the conference charter is an embodiment of a deal that was made between Bill Wilson and the fellowship as a whole that says, if you'll let me put this conference together to succeed the co-founders, and to allow this fellowship a vehicle by which it can go ahead and start taking care of its own business, we'll give you these promises in return, which are contained in our warranties, and we'll get into those in a little bit later. But it is a handshake deal between Bill, and what is now the General Service Conference and the fellowship as a whole, because there's nothing legally binding between the fellowship and the General Service Conference itself, and the conference and the General Service Board. So if we decide that, you know, we get a big wild hair and decide that we're not going to have a conference anymore, the General Service Board will continue. They will continue through the predicted survivability of the end of the corporations, I suppose, and then when the money's gone, everybody goes home, I guess. So this, just to dissolve the conference isn't necessarily an answer to any problem that we've got. How does the conference work? What funds it? Well, AA group contributions primarily. And publishing income, because we typically don't support ourselves totally in the level of group contributions matching conference and group expense. And it also relies on the force of tradition. We're in our 50th year of this conference. And so it's become kind of an icon part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's generally accepted by the bulk of the population of the fellowship. It is not without detractors. Hardly any that I know of, but there are some. And these detractors sometimes can raise all kinds of hell. If the groups feel strongly enough as a whole, now if you can get all the groups to agree on anything, good luck. But now if they as a whole decided that they didn't agree, this conference is all wet, and you're wrong, they yank the plug on the money. And that's the ultimate authority. That is the ultimate authority that the groups have. But with that comes a responsibility, and this is, you know, you don't ever want to offer that as an option without saying, okay, now what's the other side of that coin? What's going to take its place? The DCMs and the district committee? I don't think so. We can't agree within committees about what we're doing. So this is this process and this thing that they've got outlined in here seems to work pretty good. But this is the, you know, if the groups absolutely were compelled to do it, if the trustees and the General Service Board and, in fact, the conference, which is a product of the group conscience, if they got so sideways, ultimately the groups could yank the plug. When I was delegate, I've never believed that that's the problem. I think we ought to just flood them with money as groups, get self-supporting for crying out loud, and get the price of this literature down to cost. We don't even pay royalties now, except some piddly amount to some cousin that refused to die.
Well, that's over in about 2 more years.
I think that's over in 2 more years anyway, so, yeah. So, those people live a long time, them Burnhams. But anyway, I think one of them's 104 or something. I bet they weren't thinking about that when they redid that royalty deal. But the point of it is that, you know, if we ever could get to that place where we were supporting truly our services, the actual cost of the conference and everything else, the literature price would be down there to the point where we wouldn't have to depend on these damned overages to keep supporting our services. And then our literature copyrights, not only in this country but worldwide, they just are so ridiculously small of a problem because the price of our literature is so low, we don't have any competition. And so we're able to keep the integrity of our message. But boy, once it gets to a certain threshold, it's just like everybody and their dog's a publisher.
I was just waiting for what was left.
That's a good stopping place.
The trustees are responsible by law, by New York law, for the management of the money, the keeping of the property that we rent. We don't own it, we rent it, and certain other legal obligations. When I came on the board, I had to sign personal responsibility note that I was responsible for over $8.5 million. Made me nervous. But that's the way it is under the law. If anything went wrong, I don't know, even, who would I get that kind of money? Where I told you how we discovered that only the trustees could vote in committee, so we're not allowed to legally have anybody but the trustees voting in committee. Because the trustees are responsible for what goes on, there are some ways that the trustees are responsible to stop certain conference actions. Even though 2/3 of the conferences do something, there are some circumstances where the trustees must not do that. And they're clearly defined here. If in a time of heavy stress, the conference should take an action in clear violation of its own charter or that of the General Service Board, and the trustees have to say, no, legally we cannot do that. It has to be reconsidered. And there's a process that's set up for contacting the delegates and all that. Although traditionally the trustees should never substantially exceed the conference-approved budget, they should feel entirely free to reduce the budget during any fiscal year if they see it's necessary. If by reason of unforeseen conditions, any particular plan, project, or directive of the conference should become unpractical or unworkable during the fiscal year, the trustees should, without prejudice, be able to use their right of veto and cancellation. If it turns out that going to those conferences with the CPC turns to be a bad thing for some reason, we can stop it. Altogether, we can stop any of the things we're doing, and the trustees are responsible for that legally, and we've given them the authority to do that. The other side of it is, as the trustees, we understood clearly that the conference charter took precedence over that unless it was a legal matter, that we would never go contrary to the conference unless it was seriously going to get AA in trouble, meaning we could lose our nonprofit status and our charter, which would put us out of business. We could not legally touch the $10 million a year we need to get at. So it's an interesting balance. It's a little schizophrenic back there. And so we have hired some folks. We won't lose any more copyrights because we now have some attorneys who are continually checking and updating where we stand with copyrights and trademarks. A little extra expense, but it'll keep us out of trouble. So those are some of the trustee responsibilities, to make sure that you are not distracted from your 12-step work.